Wow. It is so, so good to be here with you guys. And can we just give it up for Bethel for leading us in a time of worship? So, so amazing. You can have a seat. So I'm from a small country in Central America called El Salvador. And if you're at all familiar with El Salvador, you know it's kind of an intense and violent country. And so I grew up indoors a lot. And my grandparents raised me, so I had my grandfather teaching me his version of sports, which was chess. And so from the age of around 3 or 4 years old, I was playing chess every day. And my grandfather is incredibly competitive. So he would beat me in 5 moves, 6 moves, 7 moves, and I would cry. I was 5. And I would say to my grandfather in Spanish, "Papi, let me have a move." And he would look at me and say, "When you earn a move, you can have a move. Checkmate." So I spent the next several years of my life earning 8 moves, then 9 moves, then 10 moves. But he taught me something so important in life. When we sat down in that game of war, I had one intention, and that was to cause his king to surrender. And everything else I did, every other move, had to submit to this one intention. I needed to know what I wanted. I need to organize every decision I made to accomplish that goal. Have you ever had people ask you stupid questions, and then you're supposed to respond as if it was an intelligent question? My grandfather, who lived to be 99 years old and 11 months, he made it his goal to live to 100. He knew what he wanted. He said, "I'm going to live to 100. And when he got to about 99 and 9, 10, 11 months, he started getting a little tired. And he said, "You know, I think I'm already 100. Because everyone says 1 after you've been here a year. They don't give you credit for the first year. So I'm actually 100 years old." And then he passed away. And before he died, he told me, he said, "I remember when you were just 4 or 5 years old, your older brother asked you a question. And when he asked you the question, you gave him an answer, and he looked at you with such condescension, and he said, 'That's a stupid answer.' And my grandfather said, I remember you immediately responded to your brother, 'Ask me a stupid question, you get a stupid answer.' I have lived my life with a lot of questions. Why are you asking me that? I've been married for over 30 years. And if you've been married a long time, you know that your wife will ask you a lot of questions that she doesn't need to ask you. Like, where did you park the car? I don't know why she asked me that. If I don't know where it is, why is she asking me? Where did you lose the car keys? I hate that one too. Why did you break it? Well, I was thinking about it ahead of time. I'm going to break this before I try to fix it. I love the general question she asked me. What were you thinking? Clearly, nothing. And as I thought about all the stupid questions I've been asked in my life, "Are you okay?" You wouldn't be asking that if I was okay. I'm clearly not okay. I still play basketball. I'm 57 years old. My wife has no empathy for me. I come home injured, and she goes, "What's broken now?" So I was reading a moment in the life of Jesus, and he asked a question, and I had this thought, that's the stupidest question I've ever heard. But I tried to stop it because I didn't want Jesus to hear me say that. So I didn't say it outside. I said, "Don't write that down. Just think it. Is that way he doesn't know you're thinking it." But I had this moment. I mean, have you ever read the scriptures and thought to yourself, "That's stupid. I know you're not allowed to think that, but you do think that." Well, there's a moment in the life of Jesus, and he asks what might be the stupidest question ever asked, except, of course, Jesus asked it. So, Lord, I know it's not stupid. It's in Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 29. It says, "As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. 2 blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, 'Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us.' The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, but they shouted all the louder, 'Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. Jesus stopped and called them. And here it is. Here's the stupidest question I've ever heard. What do you want me to do for you? I know it's supposed to sound profound and spiritual, but really, Jesus, this is what you could come up with. Two blind guys are screaming their guts out, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. And you look at them and they're clearly blind. And you don't know what they want. I mean, Jesus, if you're God, you kind of already know that. And even if you were not God, you could sort of intuit what they wanted. I think you could pick it up. Jesus stopped and called them. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. Lord, they answered. We want our sight. Oh, that's what you, I would have never known. So clarifying. We want our sight. Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately they received their sight and followed him. And I think when we read this kind of encounter from Jesus, we're overwhelmed by the power of Jesus to give sight to the blind, or are moved by the compassion of Jesus that he cares so deeply about each individual that has ever walked on this planet. But in the midst of that, we overlook that part of the conversation that I'm convinced God wants us to step into. When Jesus asked the question, what do you want me to do for you? That question was not incidental. That question is one of the most significant questions we could ever be asked of by God. Because if you do not know what you want, then God cannot give you what you need. And if you do not understand that God will not force himself on you, impose himself on you, demand himself on you, that God in his graciousness, in his generosity, in his kindness and gentleness, that God waits for us to invite him into our lives to do what only he can do for us, we will not understand the power of this question. And I wonder today, do you know what you want? Because if you don't know what you want, don't get mad at God that he never gives you what you need. Because if Jesus encounters two blind men walking as he walks down through Jericho, and they cry out to him, have mercy on us, and he stops and says, I'm going to ask you a question. And when I ask you this question, I need you to really think this through. Because you have a moment with the creator of the universe. What do you want me to do for you? What were the options here? Jesus, I don't know if you can tell, but we're blind. And we heard you're a carpenter, so you're really good at wood. Could you make us canes? We would really appreciate it if you could use your carpentry skills and make us some canes. That way we can get around a little better because we're blind. Or maybe they would upgrade that request and say, you know, Jesus, we would love a Roman chariot. I just, you know, one time, even though I'm blind, I can feel, I would love to feel the rush or the wind against my hair. I think I have hair. And that way I could have an experience, even though I'm blind, I could carry that memory with me all my life. See, I think there's something unexpected that happens here. That God is trying to press into our souls. That if we ask God for too little, we will live our lives disappointed because we thought God was more than that. See, I think a lot of us actually protect God by praying small prayers. I think a lot of us are terrified to ask God to do big things in us and through us and for us because it might prove that God does not exist. And so we pray small prayers that we can actually fulfill ourselves. We pray prayers that won't get God in trouble, won't put God in a dilemma, because we don't want to push God into a corner where we ask him to be God and we find out he's less than we thought. But God does not need you to protect him or his reputation. God is bigger than your prayers. He's bigger than your dreams. He's bigger than your challenges. He's bigger than your fears. He's bigger than your doubts. He's bigger than you. And he's waiting for you and for me to call on him as the God that he is and ask big dreams and big prayers and call for big visions. God is looking for the person who's not afraid of the big ask. Do you know what you want? I don't think it's incidental that when they're shouting out to Jesus, the crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet. You know what I've discovered in my own life? Is that when you ask God for big things, people don't start cheering you on. See, it's really important to pray humble prayers so that you don't think too much of yourself. Because if you start praying big prayers, people will look at you and say, who do you think you are praying a prayer that big? Who do you think you are asking God to give you your sight? I mean, after all, you are no one. These two men do not even have names. They don't show up on any record. Why would Jesus take the time and energy and effort to give them sight when there's nothing about them after this? Doesn't Jesus only answer big prayers for big people? And so they rebuked them because they did not feel that they were worthy of asking Jesus for so great a thing. See, I think a lot of us feel like those blind men on the side of the road. And we don't want to be intrusive on God. We don't want to ask God for more than we should or more than we deserve or more than we ought to. And so we keep our prayers humble so that no one will think we think too much of ourselves. If no one is rebuking you for your prayers are too small. If no one is looking at you with some suspicion, looking at you saying, who do you think you are praying that kind of prayer? Who do you think you are having that kind of dream? Who do you think you are expecting God to give you that big a life? And you can respond, I know who I am. I'm just a blind beggar on the side of the road, but Jesus is walking by and I'm not going to get lost in the crowd. Because it's not who I am. It's who he is. And I get it. I'm blind and I do not deserve my sight. But I found that God is always willing to give us so much more than we deserve. But he doesn't give us more than we ask. He lets us choose how small a life we will live. I didn't grow up in church. I didn't grow up in faith. I'm an immigrant from El Salvador that was so religiously confused. My grandmother was Roman Catholic but never went to Mass. My grandfather was an atheist who believed in reincarnation, who took me to a house and said a little 9-year-old boy had died and was reincarnated, and that's who my grandfather was. So I was taught to pray to Jesus, and I believed that we came back over and over and over again. My mom became a Buddhist, and we were the first Latin Buddhists in the world, I think. She brought a Buddha home, hoping that Buddha would help us out. He wasn't very helpful, so later she destroyed him in the backyard. My stepdad was a pure pagan, just pure atheist. He made a living with creative underground economies. And so he had a different religion. I grew up reading every mythology book in the library, and I had no idea who God was. So I didn't know how this worked out. I never really knew who Jesus was until I was around 20 years old, and someone handed me a Bible, and they told me that God was the God of the scriptures, and if I would pray, God would hear my prayers. If I would believe that God would honor my faith, my trust in him. But I wasn't sure how it all worked out. And here I am trying to live my life now for Jesus and trying to bring him honor and pleasure and to help people come to know him. You ever have something terrible happen in your life when you think you're doing everything right? So here I'm in college and I'm trying to talk to everybody about who Jesus is. And I also played on the soccer team and I have bad knees and I got hit really hard in a particular match. I had to take me over to the hospital And that night I was in so much pain. And my roommate had built a loft in the dorm room where we slept up high so we could turn the bottom into a living room. And in the middle of the night, I just kept rolling back and forth and back and forth because I was in so much pain. And before I even realized it, I rolled out of that loft and I fell right on top of my roommate's army surplus locker. They make those things so solid. And I hit that metal corner with my elbow. And when I hit that thing, it broke the radial head off my elbow. And my roommate, whose major was sports therapy, just laid there. And as I moaned and groaned on the floor, he finally said, "Did you drop something?" I go, "No." And he goes, "Is that you?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Okay." I said, "I think I need to go to the hospital." He goes, "I'll take you in the morning." A lot of love there. So I laid there all night, cold sweats, fever, agonizing pain. In the morning, I got myself to the hospital. And they x-rayed my body and they told me that I would never move my arm for the rest of my life. And the only expression I had of my faith at that time is I was a musician. And so I would write music and play the guitar and sing and do these festivals and concerts. And now I'm told that my arm is stuck and I would never move it again. I'm in sports rehabilitation at the University of North Carolina Medical Center and they're graphing my movement at 0000. I cannot tell you how confusing that was to me. Say, "Jesus, I trusted you with my life and I'm trying to give everything I have. And I'm just 21 years old and I am broken." And then I got a phone call. This festival was coming from Canada to North Carolina and they heard about me. So they wanted me to perform at their festival. And I had just broken my arm a couple days before and when they asked me if I would perform, I just said, "I'll be there." I didn't know how I was going to be there. I didn't know how I was going to play. I just said, "I'll be there." And I hung up the phone. And I sat down on the sofa and I grabbed my guitar and I put it on my lap and I prayed the biggest prayer I'd ever prayed in my life up to that point. I said, "Jesus, I just want to play for you. I just want to do this so that I can declare your name." And I said, "Jesus, would you just move my arm to the guitar strings so that I could at least play the guitar? That's all I'm asking. I'm just asking you to move my arm from where it's stuck to the strings so I could play." And in that moment, I cannot explain this to you, but in that moment, my arm moved from where it was stuck and it just instantly moved right to the guitar strings. And I was overwhelmed. I thought, "I cannot believe, God, you could answer a prayer so fast." And then I had this thought. That was the stupidest prayer I've ever prayed in my whole life. I could almost hear God. Like, "Watch this. He's about to pray, and I'm about to heal him. Watch. I'm going to do a God-sized thing." But I didn't have a God-sized prayer. I said, "God, Jesus, could you just move my arm? It's just over here." It's like, I'm not asking you for a whole lot. You could probably assign this to a middle manager. And when I moved my arm right here, I had this thought. I realized, what was I thinking? If God would move my arm from here to here, if he would heal my arm that much, I'm pretty sure he was ready to heal my arm completely. That was Easter weekend. The rest of it came hard. I sat by a piano and just started playing up and down the strings, trying to give my arm mobility, and the pain was excruciating. It was almost as if God was saying to me, "I gave you from my power what you asked for. But because your faith was so small, you're going to have to work for the rest of what I was ready to give you." And I remember when I went back to the hospital and they measured my mobility and they said, "All right, let's see what you got. 0000 every single day." And I go, "How do you want me to move my arm? Like this, like this? How do you?" And because I was so new, I didn't know any better. And I told them all about Jesus and how he healed me. See, and I think a lot of us, we pray prayers that actually reveal our lack of faith in what God wants to do in us. What do you want me to do for you? What do you want? What kind of life do you want? Do you have the life you want, or do you just have the life you got? See, I think a lot of us, we're not living the life we want, we're living the life we've got. And the reason we never live the life that we want is because we don't know what we want. And God keeps waiting, ask me, what are your dreams? What's your vision? What burdens you? What fills you with passion? What sets you on fire? Ask me for something bigger than you so that I can show up and be God in your life. We want our sight. Jesus, I want my sight. I don't want to walk around with a cane showing the world how powerful God is because he made me a cane. I want to come to the God who does what I cannot do, to reveal himself to a world that does not even know he exists. You know what I love about being here? I am so inspired by Pastor Brian and Bobby. And I started thinking, what we're watching together, what we're watching is the physical materialization of what they dreamed and prayed for 30 years ago. See, Brian and Bobby, they knew what they wanted. They wanted the church to become an unstoppable force. They wanted the church to transform this continent. They wanted the church to impact the world. They wanted the church to be vibrant and alive. They wanted the church to express the dreams and passions and heart of God. And that's why we have what we have right now, because they knew what they wanted and God did it. And they're going to be haters. You know why? The haters hate because they didn't want enough from God. And so it condemns them because they wanted too little. And God did much in those who wanted more. I had a moment with Pastor Phil Dooley from South Africa. I mean, he's just like the coolest guy in the world. And I love when he was just saying so casually, because everything he says is kind of casual. That hair, you got to be casual. And he said, you know, it's not about church growth. It's about the transformation of a nation. Of course it is. That's the way we all think, right? Hey, we all woke up this morning, I'm changing a nation. But I'll tell you what, if you don't wake up with determined to change a nation, you will never change a nation. But I walk away from my conversation with Pastor Phil Dooley, I go, that man is going to be used by God to change the nation of South Africa. Because he knows what he wants. He's not afraid to ask God for it. He's not afraid to declare it. He's not afraid to own it. Because it puts you across the line of faith. When you begin to declare that you want something that you cannot do, when you begin to declare that you want something that only God can accomplish, when you begin to declare that you want something that's bigger than you, others will tell you, be quiet. They'll begin to rebuke you and silence you. And that's when you just have to find the internal resolve to get up and say, I know what I want. What do you want? And then my guys, some of our pastors are here. They're amazing. And they were somewhere in the world, and they met Pastor Chris Mendez from Buenos Aires. Yeah. And they came back and said, bro, you're not going to believe this guy. He's incredible. He's in Buenos Aires, and God's already using him so powerfully. And like, he learned all these languages, and he's just so brilliant and so gifted and so passionate. But they came back saying one thing. He said, you know, they called me to a city, Buenos Aires, but I'm going to give them a continent. I thought, of course he is. Because we all woke up this morning, right? Saying our God's too big for small dreams. Some of you are suffocating God in your small life. Some of you have a dream so small that God cannot possibly constrict himself inside of it. And you need to open up your heart and open up your mind and open up your soul and open up your dreams, open up your imagination and stop trying to make God as small as you and let God make you as big as Him. So there's this moment in 2 Kings where a woman was married to a man who lived for God and then he died. And he left them bankrupt. And now her sons are going to be sold as slaves. And they go to the prophet Elisha for help. Listen, 2 Kings chapter 4. The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that he revered the Lord, and now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves." Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" "Your servant has nothing there at all," she said, "except a small jar of olive oil." Elisha said, "Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into the jars. As each is filled, put it to one side." She left him and shut the door behind her and her sons. And they brought the jars to her, and she kept pouring. And she kept pouring and pouring and pouring and pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." But he replied, "There's not a jar left." Then the oil stopped flowing. She went and told the man of God, and he said, "Go, sell the oil and pay your debts. You and your sons can live on what is left." I think this moment is so critical for her own faith. Here's a woman who's at the end of herself, who doesn't know what to do. But instead of becoming embittered toward God, she runs to the man of God and says, "This is where I am. This is where my life is. This is what I've come to." And I love what he says to her, "How can I help you?" She goes, "I just explained to you. We're broke. Our creditor is taking away my boys. They're going to become slaves." Why does Elisha say, "How can I help you?" Because God is always going to ask you, "What do you want? How can I help you?" And then he says, "All right, tell me, what do you have in your house?" And she says, "I have nothing at all," which I think is the problem for so many of us. We just don't think we have enough for God to use. We go, "I'm not Pastor Brian. I don't have the gifting and the talent of Pastor C. Furtick. I mean, you might look at yourself like, I'm just like a small jar with just a little bit of oil. What could God ever do with me?" And I love the fact that his first question to her is, "What do you have?" And she says, "Nothing." He goes, "Well, rethink that. You have something. Because God wants that something. He wants you to take that something that you have and make it everything that you have. So that you give everything you have to God so that he can give you everything he has. There's going to be a great exchange here." She says, "I have nothing at all except a small jar of olive oil." She says, "All right. I want you to go to all your neighbors and I want you to ask them for all their empty jars," which is not really helpful. But she goes to all the neighbors. I don't even know how many she goes to. And she starts asking for all the empty jars. And he does give her one bit of insight. Don't ask for just a few. See, I love this because Elisha knew God. He knew how generous God was. He knew exactly what God wanted to do in her life. And he said, "Go ask for empty jars, but don't just ask for a few. Go get as many jars as you can." See, I think so many of us are convinced that God can barely fill our one small jar. He said, "Go get all the empty jars you can. Pull them together. And then lock yourself in so that no one can say anyone did this but God. And take that little bit of oil you have and start pouring into all those empty jars." And she poured and she poured and she poured. And by that time, she got it. God is a generous God. God does more than we could ever ask or imagine. This is the kind of God that we serve. And she just kept pouring and pouring and pouring. And finally, she says to her son, "Bring me another jar." I wouldn't want to be her son when he said, that's all we got. He said, by that time, she finally understood the character of God. She finally understood the generosity of God. She finally understood that God wanted to prosper her and to bless her and to pour into her life. Get me another jar! And he said, that's it. And the moment she ran out of empty jars, the oil stopped flowing. You know when God will stop working in your life? Not when you run out of talent. Not when you're not smart enough. Not when you don't have the gifting that's necessary. God will stop pouring into your life when you run out of empty jars to bring to Him. When you come to God and you just open yourself up in emptiness, you say, God, you know me. You know my brokenness, God. You know my imperfections, God. You know my wounds. You know my scars. You know my fears. You know my doubts. God, you know me, but here I am, God, an empty jar with just the smallest amount of oil. But I believe that you're the God who multiplies what is in me to do more than I could ever ask or imagine. So my wife, Kim, and I, we spent 10 years working with the urban poor. We went to the highest crime rate, murder rate area of the United States at the time in Dallas. We went to a zip code that was so violent that the city officers were not allowed to go down there. I spent my life with drug dealers and drug addicts and prostitutes and drug cartels. And there was no fame or fanfare. No one saw what we were doing except God. And we were going to buy some land and try to put a little church building there. It would be the first church that was put into the city in the United States after decades of white flight, people leaving the center of the city. And I saw this perfect piece of land. There was no building on it. I thought, God, just save this land for us. It was perfect. As I started walking on this land, and I would pray the words in Joshua that everywhere the sole of your foot touches, that's yours. So I would walk on that property, and people thought I was out of my mind. I would just walk around that property and say, this is mine. This is mine. We're claiming this. God, you're giving this to us. I remember one time this man came up to me. He was huge, and he was so stoned. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm walking on this property. And I'm asking God to give it to us. He goes, well, if you'll pray for dirt, would you pray for me? And so I prayed for him and became this place where people would meet me. So I went to an association of churches that we were connected to, and I convinced them to buy this property for us. It wasn't that much money, but at the time it seemed so huge. And I convinced him because I said, look, if we don't succeed, because you don't think our church is going to make it, right? He goes, no, you're not going to make it. So that's okay. If we don't make it, you can sell the property and make so much more money on it. Because after all, we're supposed to be in real estate, right? And that's a joke. So he bought the property for us. And then when they did all the testing, they did two core samples that went something like 25 feet deep. And they realized that I had led them to buy a landfill. They went 25 feet deep and never found soil. Now, I was in my late 20s, and I was so new to faith, and I was so confused why God would do this, and I felt so inadequate. In fact, I walked into this man's office. I'd never heard like a believer use any like profane language before, but that was the first time. And he went on to tell me, you know that piece of, you know, garbage you talked us into buying? And he goes, we'll never work with you again. I led them to spend their money to buy a landfill, and I felt so ashamed and so inadequate. And I thought, this is my life, my story. And other people were building these great churches and doing these great works. And I'm the pastor of a landfill. I'm the pastor of the dump. And it was so frustrating to me. And so I went to our small little congregation. I didn't have any choice. I said, we bought a landfill. We can't sell it because now we can't lie to anyone. The people who sold to us lied to us. But we can't lie to anyone, so we're stuck with a landfill. And this handful of people, and I just said, all we can do is pray that God would perform a miracle. You see, I know what was going on with these two blind men. They were desperate, and so they prayed a big prayer. See, I know what happened with this widow. She was desperate, and so she prayed a big prayer. And I wonder if we get angry with God when he puts us into desperate circumstances and we don't realize that it's only in our desperation that we start believing God to be who he actually is. And so we prayed and we prayed and we prayed, and people would come from other states and say, hey, what are you going to do with that landfill? We were famous as the church with the landfill. And then one day, one of the ladies in our church, I said, hey guys, let's pray for the landfill. And we had these guests from the outside, and one of them asked that question again, what are you guys going to do with the landfill? And I just couldn't take that question anymore. I could feel the condescension. I could feel people laughing at me. And this little lady said, oh, we've already taken care of it. We've asked God to turn it into soil. And when she said that, I thought, yeah, that's right. We know what we want. Of course, that's what we're praying. So I went back to the association. I said, I need you to do a third core sample. He goes, why? So I just need you to do a third core sample. Just trust me. And he goes, son, I hate when people call me son. Son, we've done two core samples. You know how much money we've lost because of you? I said, you've lost so much money. Couldn't you just waste another $3,000 on one more core sample? I don't know why, but he did. And I'm telling you, I'm standing before you today, that when they took that third core sample, that land that was a landfill came out soil. And I remember when we started building on that property. I remember when we put that little building right in the middle of South Dallas in the highest crime rate, highest murder rate area of the entire United States, and we put that cross on top of that little building. It was our declaration that if we give God our empty jars with just the smallest amount of oil, and then we ask him for great things, he will show up and be the great God. It's time. It's time for us to stop protecting God with our small lives and our small dreams and our small asks and our small prayers. And it's time to go big. We need to know what we want. The Church of Jesus Christ is here because we are God's strategy to change the course of human history. We're not just here to fill buildings on Sundays. We're here to bring hope to the world. We're here to prove that love is more powerful than hate. We are here to prove that the living God has not forsaken us, has not abandoned us, that God is not powerless, but that God is present and intimate and ready to act on our behalf. Be careful not to ask for too small a thing. It was Valentine's Day, just this year. I know I should have woken up on Valentine's Day thinking about my wife. And I did later. But I woke up that morning because we couldn't get to Mosaic because the roads were closed. And so we couldn't gather that morning. And I heard, it was as if the voice of God just said to me, Erwin, do you know what you want? Or are you just going to wander aimlessly all your life, wondering why I never worked in your life the way I could have worked in your life? See, I think the most painful question you ask an 8-year-old is, what do you want to be when you grow up? How are they supposed to know? We don't even know. But if you want God to do great things in your life, you better sit down and you better let God change your heart and put his desires into your fire. And know what you want. And I woke up that morning and I said, God, I want us to have a conversation with the world. That's what I want. I want to be able to have a conversation with the world about how beautiful your son Jesus is. And I said, there's a practical ask here, God. We have an opportunity to buy 4K equipment from Sony, and it's worth maybe about $5 million, and they're offering it to us for $1.6 million. And God, that's a great reduction, except that's $1.6 million more than we have. So that's a huge dilemma, God. And God, in that moment, put someone's name in my mind. Someone I'd never met, I'd never had a conversation with, didn't even attend our congregation. And I didn't even have his email address. I had to trace it through someone else's email address.
And I found it, and then I sent him a note, and I just said, hey, praying for you today. Attached to my email is a proposal you might be interested in. Because I couldn't even ask, because I was so afraid to ask. Within 5 minutes, I got an email back saying, we're in the hospital. Our little boy has meningitis. I thought, oh, I'm such a bad human being to send that email while their son is in the hospital. I said, would you pray for our little boy? Who, by the way, got healed. And then he attached to that email, and we would love to give the $1.6 million you need for this project. And I thought, Kim, I was calling Kim. You won't believe this. And so we bought this equipment for $1.6 million, and I didn't realize we didn't have enough money because there's all these other things no one tells you about. And so I got up one day and I said, you got to know what you want, because if you ask for too little, it's on you. And I just was honest. I said, I thought I knew what I wanted, but my dreams were too small. My ask was too small. My vision was too small. And now I'm here and I have $1.6 million worth of equipment, but we cannot do what we're supposed to do because I didn't dream big enough. And the guy was listening to my talk. And when I walked off the platform, he sends me an email. We want to make sure we close the gap of what you asked for and what you needed. And let me tell you, if there is a person out there who listens and says, I want to make sure we close that gap, don't you think God is listening to you? Don't you think he's here right now saying, I'm ready to close the gap between where you are and where only I can take you? I'm ready to give you a dream so big that you could never fulfill it except by my power. But you don't want to know where you got to start. You want to know where you got to begin. You have to know what you want.